Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and welcome to Friday. The weekend is here. It is December 22nd, so we've got just a couple days away till Christmas, and I love good stories. If you have one, let me know what it is. 877-933-2484. I can't get enough of feel-good Christmas stories. I want one right after the other. That's what I want. Here's one in Ashland, Ohio. A Ashland, Ohio grade schooler is being rewarded for a good deed. 9-year-old Micah Fry's grandmother was about to buy him an Xbox when he decided to spend the $300 on blankets for the homeless instead. A TV station there reported that the Microsoft executives heard about the boy's gesture and decided to gift him with an Xbox after all. Micah's grandmother says his family was once homeless, so he remembers what it's like to not have a blanket to call your own. What a sweet, sweet story. All right.
Heart of a child.
Oh, isn't that sweet? And we're going to talk to Ace Collins. Actually, I had a conversation with him a couple weeks ago because he is so busy this time of the year. He's written 95 books. He's written a great number of books on Christmas traditions, so we're going to revisit that conversation in just a minute. And it was so interesting to hear the backstory of some of the Christmas songs we love. What's one of your favorites, Rebecca?
I've always liked "O Holy Night."
You know, me too.
I think that's one of the not only is the music beautiful, but mm-hmm. the lyrics are really beautiful and thought provoking. And you don't always hear like the second verses of songs, but it talks about Jesus having the effect of the Savior coming to the world is to release us from slavery and from oppression. Mm-hmm. And when you think about that, we can all have that again, the understanding of our true sin nature and how much we actually need a Savior. Mm. And then that rises the hope and the anthems of glory that we can all sing because it makes it personal. It's not just long ago, far, far away. It's right. That every one of us had the deep need to be saved. And here is our hope. Here's the gift that we needed.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we're going to talk about your favorite Christmas song, but I did ask Ace Collins about a number of them. So stay tuned. We're going to hear from him in just a minute. It's 6 minutes after the hour. Merry Christmas. Recently, I had Ace Collins on, and I begged him to stick around and have more conversation with me because I, frankly, could not get enough. He's written, are you ready for this? 95 books. I haven't read 95 books in my life, and he's written 95 books. The one we talked about last was Christmas songs and the traditions, where they come from and the meanings behind them. And I wanted to continue a little bit of it, the stories behind the great traditions of Christmas. Ace, welcome back to the show.
It is a joy to be back with y'all.
Thank you so much. You also wrote a book in 2016 about your love for dogs. Tell us a little bit about that before we get to Christmas.
Oh, Man's Best Hero. Yeah, I just finished the third edition of that, which is on military dogs. It'll be out next year. The second edition was service dogs. The first dog just looked at various dogs that were doing their thing and actually were heroic. And some are heroic in non-traditional ways, such as therapy dogs that work with children with autism and other things. And so, you know, going back to Lassie, A Dog's Life, I remember signing when I wrote the book with Lassie for Viking Penguin probably 20 years ago. I was at Mall of America signing books and appearing with Lassie, at that time, the ninth generation Lassie. Mm-hmm. And so dogs and I have a long background besides the fact that sleeping in my office right now are two rather large collies, one on each side of my desk that I trip over from time to time if I don't look down.
Mm-hmm. And do you find, Ace, the dogs can be ministering spirits almost? They can be comforting and almost sense what you're thinking and what you're going through?
I think they're very empathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, you know, I think a dog knows when you're upset before you do. I think there's something they can sense. The amazing thing to me is the fact that dogs are so effective now and are used so much to alert people when they're going to have seizures before seizures happen. Alert people when they're who are prone because of blood pressure to pass out. They sense it before the person doesn't have the person set down. I mean, to me, I don't know that we've tapped into all the potential there is that can be found in dogs. I mean, it just blows me away on a daily basis what they discover dogs can do. And they're not simple little creatures that sit by your side. I mean, there's a lot more to them than we, most of us, ever see. And if we unlock the potential of them, even as pets, you know, I'm not sure what the limits would be for them.
Mm-hmm. Ace, I'd love to get back to our conversation that we started about some of the best loved songs of Christmas. And, you know, can we talk about, how about Hark the Herald Angels?
Hark the Herald Angels, you know, that's an old song. And when you talk about Christmas songs, it's a mix of old and new. I've always been amazed that, you know, tens of thousands of Christmas songs have been written over the years. Why are there only a few that make it? And I can answer that. It's about when they're released and what's going on in the world when they're released. This particular song, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, was really a combination of a lot of different things. I mean, Charles Wesley, founder of the Methodist Church, is one of those behind it. And he wrote the song, but he did not have the word angels in it. It was Velkin, which is a much more appropriate use of the term, because it was the heavenly host. The Velkin is what the language of the time called the heavenly host. When it was rewritten later on and married to music, they changed it to Hark the Herald Angels. Wesley would not have approved of that. He would have wanted it to have remained Velkin. And so when you're singing that song, remember the angels are the heavenly host. And in Charles Wesley's thinking, they're different than angels. They're a different breed, if you would say. And so in that way, he would be disappointed in the way that we sing it today. I think the biblical message, though, he put in it, it would thrill him to death to know that tens of thousands are still singing his song. And by the way, the music was not Wesley's either. The music was actually married to music that was written to celebrate the anniversary of the Gutenberg Press. And so you have two different authors coming together, writing music and lyrics. And after they were dead, the songs were married together to create this everlasting hymn of joy.
Mm-hmm. Ace, are there some pagan roots to Christmas?
Yeah, I would think almost everything is. And I don't look at that as bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gifts obviously can be taken back to the very first Christmas. So that's not pagan.
Right.
I mean, the wise men brought gifts. But if you look at the evergreen tree, was worshipped by many societies because it didn't die in the wintertime. And it took Boniface, a missionary, to turn it into a symbol of everlasting life and a symbol of strength in Christ. And the triangular shape of the tree, as he explained it to people who he was reaching with the message, represents the Trinity. I mean, you know, but if you think about pagan roots, all of us have pagan roots.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And we're transformed by the message.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
These songs, these pagan roots have been transformed by the message. Yes, they once may have meant this, but now they mean this because of people who were able to see the opportunity to share the faith through them, be it wreaths, be it trees. If we know the Christian meaning behind these symbols, if we know what the missionaries did when they adapted these pagan symbols, it's absolutely fascinating. By the way, a little trivia here. The original Christmas trees were hung upside down from the ceiling.
I heard that.
If you think it's hard to get one straight and you're underneath the tree,
yeah.
Imagine if you're the poor husband on the ladder.
Yeah.
And the wife said, I think it's a little more over to the right, dear. I mean, you know, that would have been a real challenge. Maybe the most misunderstood thing of the traditions is Xmas, because so many people get so riled up about the use of Xmas rather than Christmas, they don't realize that for about 1,000 years, that's the way Christians spelled Christmas. And there are several reasons for that. Ink was very expensive. Paper was very expensive. And everyone in the church 1,000 years ago, and 2,000 years ago for that matter, knew that X stood for Christ because X is the first letter of Christ's name in the Greek language. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if Paul or Timothy had seen Xmas written somewhere, they would have automatically said, worship Christ, because that's what it meant to them. When early Christians who could not read or write were asked, what faith are you? And they had to put it on a piece of paper, they wrote an X. When Christians were martyred by the Romans and their bodies were taken away, there are many times that Christians would go to that place where they were martyred and write an X in the dirt. Hey. X marks the spot where a person gave his life for his faith. X, therefore, really has much, much deeper Christian roots than most of our traditions and most of our songs do. And it wasn't until paper and ink became inexpensive that we started out writing out the entire name in these old texts. Many times when they wrote just Christ, they would put an X and people knew what it stood for. When you know that, and someone complains about Christmas, or someone puts Christmas up, a sign up to take Christ out of Christmas, you can explain to them, from a historical standpoint, you've just put Christ into Christmas for people who were Christians 1,000 years ago. And you know, it allows us to, if nothing else, to remove the anger from that symbol and give us an opportunity, therefore, to talk about our faith.
Mm-hmm. Ace, let me take a break. When we come back, more with Ace Collins in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have on our studio line Ace Collins. He's written 95 books. You think I just misspoke? I didn't. 95 books. We're talking about the great traditions of Christmas. And an interesting, Ace, you know, sometimes being uninformed is no deterrent to holding an opinion. We get all mad that they're using Xmas instead of Christmas. And actually, you've helped us think through that in a smart way. So I appreciate that. Let's talk about St. Nicholas. What can we learn about St. Nicholas?
A lot of people get upset with Santa Claus, too, because Santa Claus doesn't have Christian roots. Actually, Santa Claus's roots are very Christian. St. Nicholas, Nicholas of Baria, Turkey is the area where that would have been. He was first a priest and later a cardinal in that area. And his ministry in particular was to children, and children of all ages. And he came from a background of money. His parents were very wealthy. They died early. He inherited that money. And when he became a clergyman, he gave the money away. And then as he got money as a clergyman, he found uses for that money amongst the very poorest people. If a man's daughter could not get married because she did not have a dowry, and the man didn't have the money to actually give her a dowry, which was essential during that time, Nicholas would come by at night, and unbeknownst to anyone, would drop a coin in the house that would amount to the amount needed for the dowry.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, because stockings were in short supply, many times he would drop those coins in the stockings that were hanging by the fireplace to dry after they had just been washed. There's the stocking. There's St. Nicholas. There's the gifts. As a matter of fact, when he died in early December, 1700 years ago or so, the people continued to celebrate St. Nicholas's incredible life and witness by giving gifts to children on St. Nicholas Day. Well, then we can move forward a little bit to the 1500s and a very devout leader in what we now know as Latvia, who would go out each and Bohemia, actually. He would go out each and every Christmas on Christmas Eve and take the best from his castle, be it food, clothing, and others, and give it to the very poor. we sing about him now, King Wenceslaus. Really, that was not his name, but he would die for his faith at the age of 23 or 24. Yet his impact remains. And so Santa's DNA comes from these two people, and that were actual people who were practicing Christians who reached out to the least of these in their world. And in that way, Santa Claus is very much a part of Christmas traditions that have Christ in them. Now, let's move forward to the 1840s in the United States. You did not want to be someone celebrating Christmas in the United States before 1840.
Why is that?
And the reason is Christmas was Mardi Gras on steroids. Women and children stayed home in the safety of their homes. Men went out and got drunk and partied. The old English song, "We Wish You a Merry Christmas," that's like trick or treat. They would sit there and sing that song outside of home, and if you didn't give them what they wanted, they would come and take it. "We won't leave until we get some." While Christmas was a very sacred holiday in non-Roman influenced countries, in England and the United States, it was not. The police forces put double people on duty for the violence that happened on Christmas, the drunkenness that happened on Christmas. And a man who had studied the Christmases in Europe, Eastern Europe, really wanted his children to understand the magic of Christmas, and he wrote a poem. He was a pastor, and he wrote a poem called "A Visit from St. Nick." We now know it as "The Night Before Christmas." Now, picture this. At the time he wrote that poem, Congress met on Christmas Day, unless it was a Sunday. Most Protestant churches, other than Lutherans, did not open their doors or even recognize Christmas on December 25th. They ignored the holiday altogether. Only the Catholics and the Lutherans in America actually studied the holiday and worshiped and opened their doors. When "A Visit from St. Nick" was released and people started reading it, it took the focus off drinking and violence and carousing and a Mardi Gras type atmosphere and put the focus on children. And by 1860, at the beginning of the Civil War, Christmas had been transformed in the United States and in Europe and in England as well through the gift of Santa Claus. So if you want an old-fashioned Christmas, don't go back too far in America. And if you want to realize why we celebrate Christmas the way we do, it was because largely because of the poem, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse."
Wow. Before we go, we've got a couple minutes left. I want to ask you about some of the modern songs that you're hearing today. Do you like them? And then who are some of your favorite crooners, and what songs do you like to hear sung by who?
I don't know. When you look at secular music, I don't think it's Christmas until you've heard Bing Crosby sing "White Christmas."
I agree.
Or you've heard Elvis sing "Blue Christmas." And there's a new version of "Blue Christmas" with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and Elvis that's absolutely amazing that I just heard the other day. But I would argue Nat King Cole's Christmas song also represents that. And what an important song that was, because that was the first song that was ever introduced, Christmas song that was ever introduced by a black artist. So that really did bring color to Christmas. And before Jackie Robinson or Rosa Parks, Nat King Cole, thanks to Mel Torme's incredible song, was bringing Christmas across the globe and crossing color lines in the process. So you mentioned those three songs. "Mary, Did You Know," we were talking about this last night, is probably the latest song to establish itself as going on forever and ever and ever. I think it is now with "Silent Night" and other songs, and something that they'll be singing 100 years from now. But I mentioned earlier that it takes timing. A lot of the Christmas songs we love and hold close to our hearts that are dearly important to us, "White Christmas," "I'll Be Home for Christmas," "Have Yourself a Merry Christmas," all have something in common. They were released during World War II at a time when we were very insecure and wondered what the outcome of life was going to be. Would we be free? Would we be under the rule of Germany or Japan? It was a scary time for people. And those three songs may have been secular songs, but they opened the door to what Christmas is. The most interesting of all Christmas songs, I think, as far as the secular ones go, "Jingle Bells," because "Jingle Bells" was written on Medford, Massachusetts, about 170 years ago, by a young man who was watching people race sleighs. And it were teenagers racing sleighs to impress girls. This is really a Beach Boys song, if you think about it, or a Jan and Dean song. I mean, it was written not for Christmas, but for a Thanksgiving celebration in Medford, Massachusetts. And it was so popular when the children's choir sang it, one of the pastors asked the guy to bring the choir to church and sing it on Christmas morning, and they did. And people from New York and Boston who were there took it back to those two cities as a Christmas song. It's really a Thanksgiving song as far as its introduction goes. And it would be what influenced the way we view Christmas today. Wow. Carter Knives and all the other things came from this song that was about kids racing sleighs, trying to impress girls, that was supposed to be a Thanksgiving song.
Ace, absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show, and Merry Christmas to you, and thanks for all of your information and your 95 books you've written. We'll put that up on our website as to what direction to head for an Ace Collins book. Go to acecollins.com. We'll take a short break and then be back with more in just a minute. It is 33 minutes past the hour. We're going to take a little break for news. When we come back, our friend Adam Weber, pastor from Embrace Church in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, will be with us. Welcome back to the show. I'm always delighted when I can get a chance to speak to Adam Weber. Adam is a pastor from Sioux Falls, and he's written a book called Talking with God, What to Say When You Don't Know How to Pray. If you're still looking for ideas for gifts, that would be one. Anyway, Adam, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's always good to be back. Thrilled to be on.
Thank you so much. And I'm curious about an article you've written about how to keep a fire going, because as a pastor, you've said there's nothing almost more painful than seeing someone who was once on fire for the Lord all of a sudden watch that fizzle and go out.
Yeah, it's true. It's heartbreaking, honestly, to see someone come alive in their faith, to see someone excited about Jesus, only to see that fire and passion slowly dwindle out for maybe a bunch of different reasons, but wherever the reason is, just seeing that happen in someone's life is heartbreaking.
What about circumstances? Is that usually the thing that chokes out their fire?
Life circumstances? Yeah, it can be life circumstances, going through the loss of someone, maybe not getting a job, feeling like your prayers aren't being heard, feeling like God has abandoned you. It could be that. It can also just be the craziness and busyness of life. I mean, even in a season like Christmas, it's easy to be so distracted that we're overwhelmed, and by the end of a day and throughout the day, we just don't have any time for God in our lives. And so I think there's a bunch of different reasons, circumstances, time, just the lack of it being a priority, honestly, mm-hmm. just whether it's our job, our kids, even wonderful things like our marriage, like just putting other things before God.
Well, Adam, I don't want to channel Vince Lombardi here, but let's go back to the basics. Let's talk about what are some of the elements we need to keep in our hearts to keep this fire alive and burning for Jesus.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. To keep an actual physical fire going, you need three different elements: oxygen, heat, and fuel. And I know it's common sense to think about this, but if you take one of the three things away, the fire goes out. No matter how much of the other two you have, if you don't have the third, the fire goes out. And the same is true, I would argue, when it comes to our relationship with God. Really, there's three different things that we need consistently to keep our fire for Jesus burning and keep the coals hot. And those three things, as simple as I can put it, is time with God, just faithful and consistent time with God, time opening up the Bible and reading, time talking with God throughout the day, time just spending time with Jesus, just listening to him, being still, memorizing scripture. So first off, time with God. The second thing is community, just time with other people who love you and love Jesus, encouraging you, challenging you, speaking into your life, praying for you, lifting you up, just being right alongside you on a daily basis to encourage you to keep going, to keep running even when you feel like stopping. So that's the second thing. And the last thing is do something. All throughout the Bible, it talks about our faith being active. And so faith, our faith in Jesus shouldn't just leave us sitting still and said it should move us to do something. And so that might be as simple as offering forgiveness to someone who's hurting us. Maybe it's serving someone that we don't want to serve. It's loving our spouse when we maybe don't have the feelings. Just consistently doing things, listening to the voice of God, and being willing to say yes. And so again, time with God, community, do something. And I think the most powerful thing for me to hear, again, just as I just mentioned, you pull one of those three elements out of a fire. The same is true when it comes to our relationship with God. You pull one of those things out and the fire goes out. Because often I've found that usually we're strong at one or two of the three. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is a weakness of ours. And so we kind of neglect it when all three of those elements are so needed.
Okay, Adam, I want to break this down a little bit because you gave me time with God, community, and then do something. So I actually want to take a little bit of time to break these down. I want to ask about private time in the Word, personal Bible study, and then what about listening to God when we're so distracted? Every time I look at people walking around or standing at a store of some kind, everyone's looking at their phone. I'm just trying to figure out if our brains have become so rewired that we can't even get in a place where we can hear the voice of God because we're so distracted.
Oh, I completely agree. I actually, last Thursday, noticed the same thing. I was waiting for my kids out in my car to come out of school, and I was actually on my phone as well. I looked up, and every single parent I could see,
yeah,
talking like 15 parents in their car,
yes,
were all on their phone.
Every one
it's
of them.
Like, God, it's like, God, no wonder we can't hear from you. No wonder we can't hear your voice.
We're not even listening.
Even if we are getting into the Bible, which is so powerful, it's the place that we most clearly hear from God. Like, his word is so evident. It's so clear. He's speaking to us. But we also have to just give our ears a chance to hear the voice of God. Okay, so God, your word, okay, what do you have to say to me today? And just unplugging. And so honestly, I was so convicted. I put my phone in my back seat until, like, I was like, so the kids hopped in and they're like, "Why is the phone back here, Dad?" I'm like, Dad's going crazy. But I was so convicted because, like, God, we can't hear from you, and then we complain that we can't hear from you.
Yeah,
we haven't given you 5 seconds to speak.
I know.
So true. So important.
And now, Adam, you talk about community. Let's address the population that's introverted and community kind of they don't do well with community.
Yeah, we're all wired differently. And so some of us might love large groups of people, and some of us might enjoy just one person. But regardless of how we're wired, we do need people in our lives. I hear this specifically from a lot of men, actually, just guys feeling like, hey, I don't really need this. I work and then I just want to go home. And that's awesome, but we need, regardless of how we're wired, we need people in our lives. And so for some of us, community might be a small group of people. And by a small group, I'm talking 10 people in a room. It's, you know, husbands and wives together. Well, for others of us, we might connect best maybe one or two people. So once a week or once every other week, just getting together with somebody, just talking. What is God doing in my life? How's my soul? How's my relationships? Where do I need to be encouraged and challenged? For myself specifically, we're in a small group, my wife and I. So every Tuesday night, we're in a small group. Tonight, we're actually going on a date night. But in addition to that, I meet maybe once every other week, every third week with this one guy from my group. And we're just able to be raw and transparent. And on my worst days, I'm able to call him at any time and to say, would you pray for me? And so again, regardless of how we're wired, introvert, extrovert, we truly need people in our lives,
mm-hmm,
to support us, to encourage us, to challenge us. And that might look different. That's the thing that I don't want someone to hear. It might look different than the next person's. Again, the next person might have a group of 30 people over their house to worship together, where for the next person, maybe it's just one or two people for coffee, and you're just able to share on that level.
Mm-hmm. I think men in particular, they need friends that they can always call and always reach, or they'll always get a call back. I love the art of the 10-second friendship, where you know someone well enough, you call them and say, hey, what was the name of that guy that caught that pass 2 weeks ago? And they tell you, and you go, thanks, all right, talk to you later. And that's the whole conversation.
Yeah.
You know, versus, how are you? How are things going? How's work?
Yeah. No, men need other men in their lives. And just even in the last few months here at the church I'm at, it's been amazing to see guys reaching out for it. Just guys saying, I'm lonely, I'm struggling, I don't have my act together. Just even 2 weeks ago, I had a guy come in. He allowed me to share on Sunday about him coming in. He stopped by my office, and he just said, I feel like I'm going crazy.
Mm.
And what it got down to it, he said, I feel like I'm carrying the weight of the world on my shoulders, and no one even knows about it. And so we ended up getting on our knees and praying. But even for him, just having one other person that he can reach out and speak to is so important. I would challenge everybody to have that at least one person that they can be real with. And that's a hard thing to find. Often in our society, we flake out of everything. So
right.
We don't want depth. So we don't want depth.
Right.
So if we want that in our lives, the best place to start is us not flaking out. And so us being intentional, like, hey, if this person calls, I'm going to try to answer. If this person calls, I can't do it for everybody. But if this guy calls and needs me, I'm going to show up. I'm going to be there. I'm going to cheer him on. I'm going to show up because I just know I need someone to show up in my life.
Yeah. I'm talking to Adam Weber, pastor of Embrace Church in Sioux Falls. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. We are talking to Adam Weber, pastor of Embrace Church in Sioux Falls, and has written a book on talking with God, what to say when you don't know how to pray. I think all of us have been there. And we're talking today about being intentional and making a point of spending time with God and being involved in community and then doing something. Adam, right before we went to break, I think what you were talking about was maybe steps two and three were together. This guy came into your office, poured his heart out to you, and boy, you guys got on your knees and did something. I thought that's going to stick with me for a while.
Yeah, it was powerful because I had never actually met the man until he came in.
Wow.
And we just ended up talking about the fact and the promise that Jesus is Lord. And so, because I was like, we're not meant to carry the weight of the world on our shoulders. Only he is able. And so at the end, I said, would you mind if we prayed? And he said, I would love that. And then I shared, I said, I feel awkward asking. I've never actually asked someone to do this that I'm not really close with. Would you want to get on your knees and pray? And before I could look up, he was already on his knees.
I love it.
And I said, sometimes I know for myself, I need to physically tell my heart because I'm wired, just like what we were talking about, being consumed with our cell phones. We're just going nonstop all over the place. I told my friend, I said, sometimes I need to physically tell my heart to surrender. Like, I need to physically tell my heart that you are not Lord, only he is. And so we got on our knees and ended up praying. And it was powerful, actually. When he came into my office, he hadn't ate for 3-4 days.
Because he was so stressed out?
Yeah, he was so stressed out.
Wow. Wow.
And he said, at some point, you need to get hungry, right? And I was like, well, for me, it's usually not 3 or 4 days. It's usually about 3 or 4 minutes. But but it was powerful. He came up to me this last Sunday at Chapter Church and said, well, I'm eating again. And I was like, well, that's a good first step. But just that power in declaring that Jesus is Lord, and the guy who came in wasn't a new Christian, so it wasn't a new thing for him. But I think for all of us, just that constant act of surrender. Again, that's time with God. Like that touches the time with God part of like, Jesus, I need you. I'm surrendered to you. And then that community part too. I mean, this guy, he just needed another person just to share it with and just to speak truth into him. And also just have someone to pray with.
Yeah.
He could have definitely done it on his own, but there's power and there's also something biblical about having people alongside of us in life.
Adam, it sounds like you and I have kind of a can-do attitude as long as it involves coffee and snacks.
It's true.
I want to ask you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I want to ask you about what it's like in life when you kind of start realizing maybe I'm coasting, and is coasting a bad thing or is coasting a good thing, or how do we split the difference?
Yeah, I know for myself, it's often I'm often get stuck in a rut, and in my relationships, in work, as a pastor, in any area, as a dad, I get stuck in a rut. And instead of really thinking about things, I just kind of mindlessly go through them. And it's okay at different times to have seasons where we're not maybe being challenged or changed or whatever. But often we'll go for months and sometimes even years without just like kind of pulling our head up at a higher level and saying, am I headed in the right direction? Like, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing? Is this really what it looks like to follow Jesus, or is this kind of what I've created?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think to have those moments in your life where you just stop and, again, just kind of look at your life on a higher level, am I headed in the right direction? My wife is one of the greatest truth tellers in my life. If you have a good spouse or a truth teller, mm-hmm. She's also been my biggest cheerleader. But she's quick to say, like, hey, Adam, I don't know if you're seeing this right. I don't know if I don't know if that's true what you're kind of believing or thinking. But then I also have a close brother. Him and I have gotten together now for 8 years on a regular basis. I mean, if I need to be prayed for, if I need to be encouraged, but specifically when it comes to my blind spots, he is quick to speak in. And he's not rude. He's not a jerk. He's speaking into my life because, first off, I've invited him to do so, but also because he loves Jesus and I know he loves me. And so it's like, as a brother, he wants to speak into my life.
Adam, that's really one of the things I really love about you is you come across as very much an open book, and you've got vulnerability, and you show that all the time. And to me, that is so you're modeling such Christ-like behavior, because you clearly admit you don't have everything figured out. And as pastor of a huge church, I think, boy, that's a very bold way to live. And there's a lot we learn from that. So thank you so much for your vulnerability and your openness.
I appreciate the kind words. But I feel like I used to have this sense when I first started following Jesus that after some time I wouldn't need him as much as I did when I first met Christ. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I first met the Lord, I wanted nothing to do with God. I was vocally against Christians. I mean, doing a whole bunch of things I shouldn't have been doing. And so I thought, gosh, after following Jesus for some time, I won't need him as much as I did when I first started following him. That's actually been the opposite. The longer I follow Jesus, the more I see my desperate need for him.
Right.
So it's not like, well, I'm kind of figuring it out, and there's actually going to be a second Jesus here pretty soon, me. Like, that's the furthest thing from the truth.
Yeah.
The closer I get to Jesus, the more holy I realize he is, the more good and loving and perfect I really is, realize he is, and the more I see just how much more I need him.
Yeah.
And
well, Adam, thanks
for being.
I pray
that'd be true for everybody. So.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being on the show, and I was just reading the words you sent over. So thank you so much for coming back on the program.
Man.
Yeah.
It's always a joy.
Okay. But speaking to Adam Weber, we'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. Exodus 14:14 says, "The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." See you Monday. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.